You're listening to Well Made, a brand new podcast from Lumi about the intersection between business and design. I'm Stefan Ango, co-founder of Lumi, and today I'm joined by Jeff Veen. You might know him as the founder of Typekit. He's also worked at Adobe, Adaptive Path, and he's starting a new career as an investor at True Ventures.
Hi, Jeff Veen. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing really well, and I'm super happy to talk to you. Tell me about London, because I don't know anything about why you moved to London or what you're doing there or how long-term this is. What's going on over there?
Oh, it's long-term. I have moved here. And it's been, almost 2 weeks now. So I'm sort of just barely getting my legs under me. I moved here for family reasons, but it also turns out it's just a tremendous opportunity for the kind of work that I've been doing over the last year or so, which has been investing in technology startups and looking for a design angle in all of that. And man, that's just, it's going really well over here. There's just this great startup scene. And it's been a lot of fun. But yeah, I have young kids who are going to grow, you know, up through the whole English school system. So I'm here.
Wow. They're going to have a British accent then, right?
I know. It's already happening. They've only been here a few weeks. My daughter's 4 years old, and so she's already calling me Daddy. Oh, no.
Is your wife's family from England, Great Britain?
Yeah.
Wow. I didn't know that. So maybe it would help for people who are listening to get a quick idea of who you are. You've done so much in your career. Maybe you can give us a 37-second version.
37 seconds. Let me see. I came out of school with a degree in journalism and worked at some newspapers and magazines. And this is before the web. This is a long time ago, early 90s. But that all kind of got me into a position to be able to get a job at Wired Magazine. Back in like 1994, and I built websites for them then, which was not a job that very many people had at the time. So yeah, kind of learned how to do all of this web stuff. We all sort of learned it collectively on our own while we were building what we called at the time Hotwired, which eventually got sold to Lycos, which was this. If you haven't heard of Lycos, it's as old.
I've heard of. I'm old
yeah,
enough.
Yeah, you're old enough.
Maybe
your listeners aren't. But basically a Yahoo competitor back in the 90s, a web portal with a search engine. I worked there for about a year. It was a really weird place. Was very happy to leave. And when I did, I got together with a few friends and we started a consulting company called Adaptive Path. And we did user experience, like research and usability, interaction design, stuff like that. Again, at a time when not a lot of those disciplines were very well defined, and that company persisted for quite until just last year. Although I only stayed there for about 5 years doing consulting. While I was at Adaptive Path, I realized that the life of a consultant was not one that I wished to continue to pursue, and so I convinced my partners that we should do products as well as services. And so I hired some engineers and we developed a product called MeasureMap, which was an analytics tool for bloggers. And we worked on that for about a year and then sold it to Google, where we went over and designed what became Google Analytics. So that was a fun couple of years at Google working on analytics. And then we worked on some of the more social products. We did some work on Gmail and Google Docs and Blogger and stuff like that. So that was pretty fun. And I left Google after a couple of years to start a new company. And the product we came up with, this was the same team that built MeasureMap that had come out of Adaptive Path. And we built Typekit, which was a web font serving service that really sort of brought web fonts kind of out of nowhere into, I think, pretty much the de facto way of designing on the web today. It was super fun. It grew really big, really quickly. We sold that company to Adobe, and I worked there as the VP of design doing the transition over to the Creative Cloud and did that for a few years and then left and joined True Ventures as design partner now. So I think I went over my 37 seconds.
There's so much in there to unpack, but are you retired now? What is True Ventures like? Is that an easy job compared to like starting Typekit and doing you know, those crazy things.
I wouldn't call it easy, but it's different in absolutely every way. And I'll tell you, man, I never thought like that someday you would ask me, what do you do? And I would say, I'm in finance. it just never occurred to me. But True Ventures was the firm that invested, that was the lead investor in Typekit. I had known many of the partners there previously as friends, and it just, the fit was really good. As I was leaving Adobe, I didn't really have a sense of what I wanted to do next, though entrepreneurial something was on the horizon. But we had a good chat about it, and it turns out this is just a great way to leverage all the experience that I've had and do stuff like that. The real difference that I've seen in just the year that I've been doing it is the feedback loop is so different. Like when you're doing product work right now, right? And you can basically come up with an idea. If you've got a good process, like I know you guys do, you can sort of get that idea materialized and out in front of customers in maybe a week, you know, like maybe a few days. And then you can measure qualitatively and quantitatively, did it work? Was that a good idea? Should we fix it?
Right.
And when you're investing in companies, it's much more of like a 5 to 10 year horizon to see, did it work? Was it, you know, am I good at this? Were our instincts right and stuff like that? So that's a big adjustment to not having the sort of daily, that daily feedback as to whether the direction you're going is right or not. And I mean, our companies have lots of metrics and we can measure all of that kind of stuff and everything. But you get what I'm saying, right? Like this idea of like, we got to wait a long time to see if this works.
Sure, yeah. And what is the design angle of what you're doing now?
Well, it's really just, like I said, leveraging a lot of the experience that I've had. But it turns out that a lot of the other firms in Silicon Valley were kind of seeing things the same way. About a year ago, as I was thinking about, oh, maybe I should join True, maybe be a VC, do the investing in the portfolio, being helpful however it can. A couple of people that I really respect and know pretty well as designers did the same thing. In fact, my old boss at Google, Irene Au, who was the VP of User Experience over there, she joined Kosla Ventures and took on the title of design partner. And then the former president of the Rhode Island School of Design, John Maeda, joined Kleiner Perkins, and he took the title design partner. And then there was this great group of people that I had worked with at Google, and they all transitioned over to Google Ventures, and they were calling themselves design partners. And so clearly there was something going on. And now there's even more. There's maybe a dozen of us that all have our experience and our careers have been in design for various definitions of the term design as well. And we're all sort of practicing that in an investing context. And I find that really, really interesting that not only that, you know, a bunch of us with the same kind of experience all kind of doing the same kind of job, but that there's a market for it, that the sort of the part of Silicon Valley, the engine that runs on the capital that powers all of these companies, has started to realize that design is a crucial part of their investing strategy, like that user experience, that the quality of the experience that people have with products can take risk out of the overall investing equation. It feels like one of these overnight sensations that took us 20 years to get to, you know?
Yeah, it seems like the bar for good design is so much higher, and the expectation that startups should have well-designed products is, at this point, it's just an expectation. And what do you attribute that to?
I attribute that all to mobile. To be perfectly honest,
yeah,
I think honestly, people had an expectation of sitting down in front of a computer as being like a work thing that is generally a little bit painful, right? Like it's hard to do. Like you have to get some big, complicated spreadsheet program, and I only know how 10% of this thing works, and then I get weird error messages, and like that's what interacting with technology was for most people up until about 6 or 7 years ago. And then they got one of those computers in their pocket. And instead of like having a distinct period of time where they sat down and did painful work, they just had technology with them all the time. So they had these thousands of micro interactions a day. And it turns out that the better those interactions went, the more people sort of had an affinity for them. So that gave people this sense of like, oh, there's five different options for how I can communicate with my friend, and I'm going to choose the one that has the better experience, that doesn't cause me pain, and I'm going to do this all the time. And I think has just the bar has been raised so much higher for having things that are just fundamentally intuitive and easy to use, delightful, that it is no longer a competitive advantage to have that in your product. It's just like table stakes. You just have to have it.
Yeah. So if design is sort of table stakes at this point, what does that mean for design going further, out in the future?
Well, I think one of the things that there's this interesting intersection between that cultural phenomenon with the fact that we have people that have well over a decade of design experience now, and that those people have been in companies like, you know, Google and Facebook and Apple itself and in Silicon Valley. You have this layer now of design leadership. And a lot of those people are considering the entrepreneurial path, since building companies and starting companies and all of that has become a lot more accessible, I think, over the last, again, 6, 7, 8 years. So what that means is you have this sort of rise of the design entrepreneur, right? Like the founder of a company whose background is not computer science, doesn't have an MBA, but instead has been building and shipping and designing products for the last 15 years. And I find that absolutely fascinating. And I find that a part of that bigger cultural shift of design in Silicon Valley is the acceptance of the fact that designers can start companies and that they are getting funded to do so.
Yeah. I guess one question is, you know, as you've seen some of the companies over the past year working at True who come from that background, who come from a more design-driven background, are you seeing that they need to catch up on other sides of their business? They're maybe not as strong operationally or something like that?
No, not necessarily, but it is maybe a gross generalization, but I'll make it anyway, that the companies that have been founded by designers are not necessarily like patentable technology-driven companies. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, they're not doing the real like machinery of the internet or things like that. Again, that's a gross generalization because some of the technologies that I saw being developed at Adobe while I was there are phenomenal. It comes to stuff like computer vision and things like that. But in general, yes, it is designers that are building products that can leverage a lot of the infrastructure that already exists. Like the fact that we have AWS and Heroku and things like that now just give everybody this head start. They don't have to reinvent all of that infrastructure just to make a company that can scale.
Yeah.
Now, it's also important to say that just because a company is being founded by designers and has a really good sense of user experience in their products, it's not going to make it successful. It means that they will, all things being equal on other parts of the business model and the technology platform and all of that, I believe they'll have a higher likelihood of being successful if they do well at design. But if they don't have those other things, design isn't going to make them successful. And I think what happened earlier this year with Ardeo is a really good example. I thought Ardeo was a far better designed product than Spotify, or for that matter, even Apple Music. But it wasn't enough for it to survive because of the way in which Spotify so excelled at licensing and marketing.
Yeah, so there are those pitfalls, and you still have to run a good business with a real strategy. And I mean, I think Typekit is kind of an interesting example of this because when you look at fonts, I mean, designers know about fonts, but I think most people, they take them for granted. You know, they don't even really think about them. They know the little picker that they have in a word processing document, but aside from that, they might not be aware of the impact of fonts that are all around them. Do you think that's true? And how did you guys build such an amazing business out of it?
Well, yeah, so first of all, I totally agree with you that the vast majority of the people in the world, to them, typography is invisible. It is like flavoring, like spices in food. They may not be able to identify it, but you know they will have a sense that one is different from another, but they wouldn't say it is because of the font that was there.
Yeah, and so okay, so first you've got this resource that designers know all about, and you know, I think the sort of long-term implication of Typekit is that now businesses can design brand identities that overlap between the physical and the digital world much more than before. You know, in the past, it was like you had your corporate font, whatever you were using out in the wild for your packaging and your flyers or your posters or whatever you're making. And then on the web, you were using Arial or Helvetica.
Right, exactly. So yeah, I think that's come a long way. And that did, to your earlier question, allow us to build that business on top of the world's typography. There were two key things that we did there. One was just from a pure technology point of view, we enabled a marketplace to exist that just didn't exist before. That is, there was this little bit of technological innovation, a little bit, I should say. It was pretty significant, though it just seemed like a minor thing, that the @FontFace CSS declaration was enabled in the big browsers all at once at the end of 2008. That was something that had existed in a specification for a dozen years. Like in the 90s, the CSS had done that. There were some pretty crappy implementations back then, and then nobody ever gave it another thought. Mm-hmm. And most of the type foundries were very vocal in their opposition to it because they felt like the same thing would happen to them that happened to the music industry. And rightly so. I believe that's actually true. You search for most fonts in Google, and the second result behind the foundry website is a BitTorrent site. Like, fonts are one of the most pirated software ever. So it was this sort of little bit of technology that allowed us to do some level of lightweight protection of the font files themselves. So it wasn't as simple as simply like typing in a URL and getting the font. We did a number of small things that just made it, you had to be very deliberate if you wanted to go get the font out of a page enabled with Typekit. And that was enough to convince some of the foundries and some of the foundries that we really wanted to work with to give us a shot. And then the other piece of innovation we did was to try to unpack and normalize the weird font licensing business that's out there, where every individual font foundry has its own sets of rules and licensing agreements for what you can and can't do with each font, as well as a wild variety of pricing schemes. Everything from individual styles like bold and italic cost different amounts of money. If you step back and take a look at the industry as a whole about 6 or 7 years ago, it was just utterly complex and hard to negotiate. So many designers that I talked to were always a little like, well, I used this font with this client. I'm not sure if the client actually bought the license. They can be in violation. Like, I don't know. I bought the license. I don't know if it transfers. On and on and on. So the other thing we did on the business side of things was a standard web font license. That was it. And that was the sort of requirement for anybody who wanted to put their fonts in Typekit, was that they would use our terms. And we worked really hard on those terms and talked to a lot of foundries to find a way to do that. And then on top of those standard terms, we did standard pricing. That is, you pay a subscription fee, and we would distribute a portion of that fee out to the foundries based on how much a font was used, which, in some ways, it's very much like the Spotify model, just applied to a different kind of creative asset.
Yeah, and I think this whole little conversation goes back to that previous point, which is, in order to make that business successful, it wasn't just about appealing to designers with this cool thing that they use all the time, but it was also making it work from an engineering standpoint and from a licensing standpoint. And those are two of the major things that you had to work on that are not really designy or design driven necessarily. And so you kind of have to be prepared to get your hands dirty with that kind of stuff.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we were deep into marketplace dynamics and pricing models and like measuring CDN costs for bandwidth and factoring that, like, oh, it just went on and on and on. Big complicated algorithms for all that kind of stuff. So we had to hire some people that knew math. That was helpful.
Now, when Adobe acquired it, they were still going through their transition to services, right?
Well, they hadn't started yet.
They hadn't started.
No, in fact, that was a lot of the motivating factor in the Typekit acquisition was that we had covered a lot of that ground already, that we were selling design assets and products as services on a subscription model with payment systems and stuff like that.
Can you talk a little bit about that transition, how it felt from the inside? Because I think it's, I mean, it's one of the most remarkable transitions in the history of modern companies, I think. And it happened so seamlessly. I mean, there were a little bit of complaints here and there, but for the most part, it was remarkably well done.
I'm so glad that it appears that way from the outside. That's great.
Well, as someone who spends a lot of time in those applications, I saw it as a big benefit, because I always say that if I hadn't pirated Adobe products, I probably would have never become a designer.
Totally.
I started using Photoshop when I was, you know, in middle school, and I would have never been able to pay, you know, $600 or whatever, however much it cost at the time. And that eventually that has to break, you know. And for me, it was when I was in design school, I had to, yeah, start paying for this thing. And I was much happier to do it once Adobe switched to services. And I think it helped a lot of things. Not only was it more of a modern business model that fit in with the way people were buying operating systems now, in fact, not buying them because they've become free, but also a way to basically make money from people who were pirating their software this entire time, because pirating was easier because there was no big upfront cost.
Yeah, I remember being in a meeting one time with the CEO of Adobe and the head of sales and CFO and like all these people, and talking about the strategy and stuff. And somebody was talking about piracy and pirates. And I said, you know, instead of calling them pirates, why don't we just call them future customers?
Yeah.
And it was just like silence in the room. Like, you know, because they look at the numbers and it's like, it's an extra $1 billion in revenue that's going to piracy. And I'm like, yeah, you could also call that our freemium model. But anyway, to your point, yes, that's it. It was a very difficult transition from inside. One, because, I mean, honestly, there was 30 years of doing business was going to stop and go a different direction. That's significant no matter how you cut it. But it was also, again, $1 billion more, actually, much more than $1 billion in business that we're just going to put on the line and just say, like, we're going to do it differently now. And if you go and look at the last 4 years of Adobe revenue, there's just a huge, huge dip where there was this expectation in the spring of, what was it, 2012, that everybody would buy Adobe Creative Suite 7 or whatever the next version was. I can't remember now. And everybody would sort of dole out their $800 upgrade fee, but instead everybody switched to $10 a month or $50 a month. So you imagine this huge dip in revenue, but it's recurring revenue, and so it'll build over time. And like the executives at Adobe did a tremendous job like walking Wall Street through that and saying, we're going to come back next quarter with a lot less revenue than you're expecting, but it's all going to be good. And it was. And you look at the stock price over the last 4 or 5 years, and it's been phenomenal. Totally, totally worked. But what I liked about it was what is the point that you brought up, which is it made the software so much more accessible to so many more people. And the stark reality of that business is that, honestly, there is just no market anymore for $1,200 software. Like, nobody buys a big giant box of software with a huge manual in it for $1,200 like they did 10 years ago. And Adobe was seeing that, and the revenues on that were getting flat. They weren't recovering from the 2008 recession, and like things were looking a little troubling. And so this was an attempt to revitalize that in a way that has just made the software available to so many more people that even at the much lower price, the revenue has just been fantastic. The growth has been fantastic for Adobe.
Yeah, and you could imagine an alternate reality where they hadn't done that at least for another 5 years or 10 years. I think they could have gotten away with it. And it's a one-way switch. I mean, it's not, you can't really do that thing halfway. You kind of have to move your whole company over to that method in order to push the customers to use the new model. Otherwise, they just wouldn't. So I don't know. I think it's a really inspirational story. And I guess the question that comes out of it is, like, you know, how do you put your whole business on the line? Like, in your experience so far, you know, whether it's with the companies that you advise or the ones that you've started, when those types of things happen, how do you think through it and make that kind of decision?
Well, and that's the big difference between what I experienced at Typekit and then what we went through at Adobe, right? Because when we did it at Typekit, we didn't put anything on the line except perhaps our reputations, you know, like we've raised some venture capital, you know, obviously that was on the line, but it was nowhere near the scope and magnitude of what Adobe was attempting to do. So what it ended up with was just so much more risk analysis and modeling, and modeling that went out 5-10 years in a way that we, you know, obviously that would have been a waste of time had we tried to do that for Typekit. So the rigor involved is probably the thing that impressed me the most and that I learned the most from while I was there, which was you don't just sit in a room and say, yeah, let's try it. Okay, let's go. That sounds good. Let's build some web pages and make it a subscription service. But in fact, it was months and months and months of evaluating an overall model and figuring out pricing schemes and structure for worldwide distribution in multiple currencies and all of that kind of stuff. Just a tremendous amount of analysis that went into all of that. Not to mention then actually the tremendous amount of work that went into the systems behind it, because Adobe had no proper contemporary subscription service and certainly no user experience to sit on top of something like that, that felt like the user experiences that we use every day when we manage subscriptions and relationships with all the products we use, like, you know, Dropbox and GitHub and stuff like that. So all of that stuff had to be built from scratch, but built on top of legacy systems that, you know, this Fortune 500 company used to manage their publicly traded stock and finances. It was remarkable. Like, you don't get to just create a Stripe account and start getting recurring revenue. You have to build this stuff on top of SAP. Oh my God. It was a lesson in change management at the biggest corporate level for me.
I guess my question is, how does that ripple down to a much smaller company? Because I think even though the listeners might not be dealing with like billion-dollar companies, it might still feel like they're betting the farm on a big decision or a big change to their business model or to their company. And if you were advising them through that, what would you say?
One of the tricks, I guess, or let's call them strategies. One of the strategies we used at Adaptive Path in consulting, which is something that's just picked up from management consulting, is one of the ways that you identify a solution that's going to help a business with a problem is to find somebody lower down in the organization who has a tremendous conviction for how things should be, and then translate that conviction into language that the people in charge, the leadership of the company, would understand. And that's just like, that's a great consulting strategy to use. And that's just the advice I give everybody is to find that conviction so that you fundamentally know, no, this is the right direction. Let's find a way to do it, as opposed to, oh, there's a bunch of directions. Let's study them all and just see what the best one might be. You know, it's the same way we do design. We back it up with A/B testing and metrics and analysis, but ultimately it's about the intuition and conviction for what the right solution is that gets us to the creative solutions that we can then test.
It seems like you have such a intuitive like overlap between designing a company and designing a service and working on tools and products that are useful to designers. Do you feel like all those things are just one and the same?
Yeah, I do, sort of. You know, there's this much maligned concept of design thinking, which makes it sound like rarefied and only designers get to do it, and you capitalize the D and the T and, you know, all of that stuff. And I don't have a lot of time for that. But at the same time, the skills that we learned when doing user experience consulting for Adaptive Path, I think apply so much more broadly than just interaction design or layout or what have you. It's that they can, that idea of starting from a place of empathy for the person who's going to be using the thing that you're creating goes so much farther in all aspects of business and technology and just everything. Like, if you can instill a sense of empathy in an engineer that is responsible for administering the database, to say, like, the work you're doing is saving people time and giving them more time with their families. And you can go on and on like that, right? It's going to make that person want to do better at what they're doing. And that, to me, comes from the same training that I had when I was learning to be a designer. It is, everything that I'm making is going to affect somebody in some part of the world, and I want that to be a great experience. So whether it is the way that we wrote our terms of service or the position that we would take when having partnership discussions in biz dev deals, or how we managed our sales pipeline, like all of that stuff all came from the same position. and the same set of skills that we were using for user experience design 15 years ago. So I think that might be what people call design thinking and how you apply it to broader business in a way that you can market in a, you know, an airport book. But that to me is, that's the line through everything that I do.
I think a challenge with design-driven companies, especially the ones who are making something for designers, is that the design community is so tight-knit and enthusiastic and passionate about this kind of stuff that it can feel like you're building something that a lot of people care about, but then it doesn't pan out to be like a huge company the way Typekit was. And with the companies that you're now advising, how do you help them think to what the bigger idea is?
It's a little bit the opposite of that, in that I look for companies that have that. That's a difficult thing to teach.
Well, here's an example I'm thinking about. Like, do you know a product called Layer Vault?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, so that company shut down like a year or two ago, and they were making this like, basically what I think is a feature of Dropbox. It would be a way for designers to see changes within a file and communicate with clients or other people. But really, it felt like it should have been something within Dropbox, a way to see the iterations for design-specific files. I think what ended up happening is they realized that the market wasn't big enough or the opportunity wasn't big enough that they could really sustain that business. It feels initially like there might be something there just because designers happen to be really passionate people. Or maybe I'm looking at it wrong. I'd love to hear your thoughts on it.
No, I think so. And I think one of the real challenges there is that designers also are very, I guess the word is rigid in how they work, in that it's very difficult to get somebody to change the way they work. I mean, look at the transition that's been happening between Photoshop and Sketch. Mm. And just how many people absolutely love Sketch, but how slowly that transition actually is really going. Because you get Photoshop like wired way down into your like reptile brain, you know, like, and that's how people work. And I think asking people to take additional steps in their pre-existing workflows, which is, I think, a little bit what Layer Vault was trying to do, to say, instead of sending an email with feedback, go to this web page. I mean, that was essentially the thing they were trying to get people to do. And that was, I think, too much to overcome. So I think Envision or companies like UXPin, which is one of the companies we invested in, are doing a much, much better job of doing that outside of the traditional workflows that designers have been in. I think another problem with Layer Vault might have just been the economics of it, in that they were essentially hosting these giant PSD files, and the value that they were providing for people wasn't enough for them to pay to cover their costs, I think. But it's hard to say. It's all, again, in retrospect. But I thought it was a beautifully designed sort of work-in-progress versioning control collaboration tool. I thought they were doing a great job.
So how did you go about talking to designers when you were selling Typekit to people? Like, what did you guys do to make it work? And side question, how did you figure out the economics would work for it?
We were able to get the economics to work by just being very, very careful with fractions and fractions of pennies, like all the way down, and really modeling it out so that we could make a go of it. To me, I think one of the biggest successes that I personally felt was around the marketing that we did for Typekit, which was very, frankly, technical, in that we were figuring stuff out about web fonts, and then we would implement them, and then we would tell people about them. And it was just so simple that way, you know? And we could then augment that with just frequent, week by week, new releases in the library. We got these new fonts, and we figured out this thing with how, you know, the timing of web fonts in the DOM is working, and so we've adjusted it, and now you can do this. And we just kept that up sort of relentlessly. And again, like, this is 6 or 7 years ago, so the lean startup thing was really new, and we practiced that religion fervently. We would chop every feature we could up into the smallest bite-sized pieces and then release them continuously day by day. This is also the time when marketing via Twitter was very new. God, it sounds like so long ago, and it just really wasn't. But all of that stuff was new. And so, you know, our conduit was Twitter and our blog, and we would have new stuff to share with people 2 or 3 times a week. And we had this momentum that felt like if you were following Typekit, there was always something new to go check out. And it was not just new, but digestible. because it wasn't some huge new version of something that you had to wait months for.
Yeah. And I think the flip side of what I was talking about with the passion that designers have, it is also a good thing when you are selling something like Typekit, or in the case of what we make at Lumi, oftentimes there is a distinction between who is the end consumer. In this case, with fonts, oftentimes you could say the end consumer is the person who's visiting the website. So the millions of people who are actually like seeing the fonts. Then there's the person who's making the decision, and that is, in your case, it was probably a designer or a developer. And then there's maybe someone like their boss who needs to agree to paying this monthly fee now. So there's different parties that you have to deal with. And if you do a really good job talking to designers and getting them excited about the value of what you're doing, they become this incredible advocate for you with their users and the rest of their company, right?
That's right. And we would look week by week at all the new... So we had enterprise accounts too, which were just much higher volume and much more expensive. And we would look week after week at these new enterprise accounts that we were creating, that we were selling. And in every single case, there would be three or four free or individual paid accounts with the same email addresses already that had been signed up for months already. So it was very clearly something that was being, like most of our enterprise sales was being done by the designers in their companies trying to convince people higher up that we should be using web fonts on our website. So that was a key learning for us too.
You know, there's that quote from Mark Andreessen that software is eating the world. Do you think when he says that, it's also design is eating the world? It's like good design is coming to every part of what we do?
Yeah, I think it's sort of a... I totally agree with his sentiment there, that there's only a few really pure technology companies, and that almost every other company now just is going to be as if it were a technology company. You know what I mean? Like... Both Netflix and HBO are technology companies, just straight through, right? The Major League Baseball is a technology company now, right? They just have to be as good as Google or Apple at the stuff that they do. What I think that means is that the kind of design that's going to be valuable is different now, whereas people's exposure to design in the past might have been like, what is the label on the box of detergent I'm buying, or how does my toaster work? Now, everything is going to be interaction design mediated by a screen or by voice or by messaging or things like that. And that's a fundamentally different kind of design than we've done in the past. It's inseparable now from hardware design or industrial design, as we've called it. And that's just such a huge change.
Yeah. And I think as an investor, this seems almost like a rhetorical question, but you're optimistic about the future in that way. I mean, right?
Yeah, we've only scratched the surface. Like, we've only barely gotten started. What, it's maybe a third of the world is even online? Like, oh my God. Like, we have so much farther to go. Just think of what's going to happen in the next decade with transportation. Oh my God. Like, we haven't even scratched the surface with the change that's going to happen to the world.
Tell me about transportation. Let's end on that topic, because it's one that I'm really passionate about, and I'm curious to hear what you're seeing for the future.
Well, sure. I mean, I spent the last 20 years in San Francisco, and most of it was inaccessible to me until Uber came around. Like, the fundamental, like, who thought cell phones would disrupt the taxi industry? I am absolutely fascinated by what's happening with autonomous vehicles and just how fast that's going. And people, I still hear people say, oh, it's 10, 15 years off. I just think it's going to happen slowly for the next couple of years, and then all at once. It's just going to, like, it's going to be one of those things where, like, oh my God, how did we ever let a human steer one of these things? That was ridiculous. And we can't even, you couldn't look back 10 years and imagine what the phone would do to change the world. I don't think we're going to be able to look forward 10 years and imagine what that sort of technology is going to do to fundamentally change the way goods are shipped around the world, the way we get around, the expectations for how our cities are even designed. Like, oh my God, it's phenomenal and it's massively exciting. That just makes me thrilled to be alive right now.
Do you know Brett Victor? Have you seen his work online?
It sounds really familiar. I'm sure I've read it.
Yeah, he used to work for Apple. He has some very interesting articles about technology and software and all kinds of things. But he made this very simple diagram that changed my life, which explains what a tool is. And it's a picture of a hammer and a hand holding the hammer. And it has two arrows. this part fits the problem, this part fits the user. You know, which one is labeled, but it's all about converting what you as a human being have, which are arms and hands, into an action that you want to perform on the world, which is nailing something. And when you think about the world like that, it becomes so weird. Like, a car is really all about converting what arms and legs can do into forward motion. And that is pretty weird. Like, I do think that in 20 years, when my kids are growing up or my grandkids, that's going to seem totally insane, I think, to kids in the future.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's exciting.
All right. Well, is there anything that you want to tell the people who are listening? What, you know, they can find you on Twitter. They can maybe pitch you.
I'm at Veen, just my last name, at Twitter. That's where I tend to put most stuff these days. Yeah, that's really it.
You have a prolific blog that has a lot of, I mean, it hasn't been updated in like several years at this point, but all that stuff is still super valuable, and I'm glad you kept it online because there's a lot of interesting insights there. You've talked at length, through in different podcasts and videos about your career, and I hope people go check that out because there's so much good stuff there. Is there anything else? Should people go check out the True Ventures website if they're trying to figure out whether you might be a good fit for whatever they're doing?
Yeah, trueventures.com. We just did a redesign with Mule Design. It was really fun.
It looks really nice.
Oh, thanks.
It looks really nice.
That was fun.
Cool. Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Psst. Hey, you. Thank you. Thank you for listening to the very first episode of Well Made. This is a brand new thing that we're trying out. We're going to be talking to a number of very interesting designers, business people, bringing other members of the Lumi team on to talk about what they're working on. And we just want to hear your feedback. We'd love to know if this is interesting to you, what you'd like to hear more of. So follow us on Twitter. We're just at LUMI Lumi, and tell us what you think. And if you love the show, please consider reviewing it on iTunes. Thank you.